didn't you, Anita?
Ah, that's a wonderful question. I feel like if they can do this, living under the circumstances that they are in, then I have to keep going doing what I'm doing. It changes me in that I feel like I take so much inspiration and courage from them. If they can do it, and they're, you know, kids, 19, 20, and 25, if they can do this, then we have to just keep going and doing everything we can possibly do to help people be aware of what's going on.
Well, you and your poems documenting this genocide day by day, and then taking on the students, Anita, with your special talents, not only as a great poet, but as a psychotherapist for young people. This combination that you bring to this moment is crucial. So we thank you for that. And we're out of time.
Thank you, Dennis.
Thank you, Anita. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacific Radio.
This is Norman Sylvester, the Boogie Cat. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, community radio.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from the Bureau of Labor and Industries Child Care for Construction, working to provide resources and support for new journey workers and their families in partnership with Business Oregon. More info at oregon.gov/BOLI/apprenticeship under the link Financial Assistance for Registered Apprentices.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 0.
Never been done before.
We're talking about a subject.
Welcome to Hard Knock Radio on the Pacific Radio Network. This is Kalonji Changa filling in for Davey D. We'd like to start off this broadcast by saying, giving you a happy Revolutionary New Year's, and to start off by saying, be careful out there, be safe. We know that, you know, as of now, as of this date in 2026, we recognize that the U.S. has continued its international gangsterism by launching an offensive on Venezuela. We know that the president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, has been kidnapped along with his wife, and he's being held in the state of New York. With me today, our guest, Leonardo Flores, who is a Venezuelan political analyst and activist and founding member of the Venezuela Solidarity Network. Flores has appeared on Democracy Now! As a guest. He was featured in a segment in which he and historian Alejandro Velasco discussed the Venezuela opposition and post-election crisis following the contested July 2024 election. We know that he is very sharp, very bright mind, and we wanted to tap in with him today to talk about what's going on in Venezuela and its history. Leonardo, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Kalonji, not just for the nice words, but also for the invitation today.
Absolutely, absolutely. For folks who aren't familiar with you, we know that you're a journalist as well. Can you talk about some of your recent works?
Sure. So I'm Venezuelan. I live in the United States. I'm Venezuelan American. I actually used to work at the Venezuelan embassy for about a decade as a media analyst and then political analyst and interpreter. Then I worked at Code Pink as a peace activist. And since that time, I'm basically a freelancer, but doing a lot of solidarity work, not just on Venezuela, but Latin America based and locally here in Washington, D.C. as well.
Powerful, powerful. Give us your take. I mean, you know, the world. You know, we saw what happened a few days ago, and there are plenty of people who are, I guess they're new on the block. They're saying, I can't believe that they would arrest a sitting president. I guess they don't remember the Philippines. I guess they don't remember the assassinations of Muammar Gaddafi, or they may not remember the lynching of Saddam Hussein. Give us your take on what's currently taking place and how did we get here?
Yeah, I mean, really, it's quite shocking what occurred late Friday night, early Saturday morning, when the United States carried out an operation, a military operation, bombing Greater Caracas and killing at least 40 people. That's the latest I've heard, but I think that number is set to go up. In a successful attempt to kidnap not just President Maduro, but also his wife. And they are, as you mentioned, in New York City at a detention center awaiting, you know, being a trial eventually, I suppose. And this is just yet another escalation in the U.S. war on Venezuela. It's a war, really, it depends how you count it. But to me, it started at least in 2002 when with a U.S.-backed coup against Hugo Chavez at that time, a coup that lasted less than 48 hours because the people demanded his return, and he was returned. And actually, what we're seeing throughout Venezuela right now, it's not the opposition who is out in the streets celebrating. They are nowhere to be seen because Trump threw their leader under the bus in a press conference on Saturday, January 3rd, when he said that Maria Corina Machado, the opposition leader, you know, was not fit to rule and that she wasn't popular. And I think that's, you know, the one true thing he may have said in that press conference. But right now, the streets of Venezuela are filled with the revolutionary base, or members of social movements, of communes, of unions, who are demanding the return of President Maduro. And, you know, they may have kidnapped the head of state, but they haven't destroyed the Bolivarian Revolution. The government is still in power. The military is still united with the people. So while it's a big blow for Venezuela, it's certainly not a knockout blow. And it really, it's perhaps the beginning of a new phase of intensity of what the Trump administration in its first term called a maximum pressure policy. And now we see that maximum pressure has escalated from sanctions, which were devastating enough. And we can certainly, I hope we talk more about that later, so I can go into some more detail. Sanctions, and now we're seeing military action beginning in August of this year with the deployment of the U.S. Navy to the Caribbean coast right off of Venezuelan international water, Venezuelan territorial waters, excuse me. And the subsequent, I believe, for folks that do not know, Venezuela has the largest reserves of oil in the world. And it's not just oil that Venezuela has. It's, you know, they're top 10 in natural gas. And they're actually probably going to be higher in that once those reserves are, you know, before a reserve gets certified, they have to go through certain processes. So I'm sure it'll go up in its natural gas reserves. They have, you know, among the world leaders in gold and diamonds and iron, bauxite, rare earth minerals. So there's a lot of mineral wealth in Venezuela that the United States wants to get its hands on. And that's been the focus of U.S. policy for, you know, many decades, but particularly since 2017 when the United States began imposing oil sanctions on Venezuela. And it devastated the oil sector in Venezuela, right? So the government revenue, and the government at the time was basically almost entirely financed by oil revenue, it fell by 99% because of the sanctions. But slowly but surely, Venezuela has been, you know, restarting their oil production. And in fact, over the last 5 years, despite the sanctions, despite the economic warfare, Venezuela has had economic growth. And part of this, the kind of resurgence in oil is because, you know, there's been massive investment by China, there's been massive investment in aid by Russia, by Iran. And so these countries helped Venezuela get back on their feet. And now the United States is using that as an excuse to attack the country, basically. They're saying that, so the Trump administration, about a month ago, they published this thing called the National Security Strategy, which outlined its vision for not just for the Western Hemisphere, but for the world, but in the Western Hemisphere in particular. They are basically calling for a return to the Monroe Doctrine. And they added this thing that is now being called the Trump Corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, where they say, and this is a quote from the report, "We want a hemisphere that remains free of hostile foreign incursion or ownership of key assets. We want to ensure our continued access to key strategic locations." So one of the impetuses behind this attack on Venezuela is to get rid of Chinese and Russian and Iranian influence. And when I say influence, I mean really trade. You know, it's not like these are malign actors. These are countries doing business in another country that they have very friendly relations with. But the Trump administration has decided that somehow the oil in Venezuela belongs to them, belongs to the United States. And Trump himself said so very clearly. And he said not just the oil, but the land. You know, nobody actually knows what he means when he talks about the land in Venezuela somehow belonging to the United States. But certainly the attitude that we've seen from the United States indicates that they truly believe that Venezuela is theirs. And so now Trump is talking about that it's the United States that's going to be governing Venezuela. I don't think that they're going to find the Venezuelan government to be compliant in that regard, or the Venezuelan people for that matter. But yeah, this is entirely, I mean, it's not entirely, there are other big reasons, we can go into them, but one of the primary reasons is oil reserves. And in particular, because Venezuela's oil is known as being both heavy and sour. These are kind of oil terms. I'm not an oil guy, but I do know that Venezuela's oil was perfect for the refineries that they have in the Gulf Coast off of Texas in particular. And with the Trump basically shot the U.S. economy in the foot by blocking Venezuelan oil, forcing these refineries to try to switch and try to find other venues for oil. But now they think that they're going to get their hands back on this oil. And the thing is, Venezuela never said that, you know, that the United States can't buy the oil. The U.S. imposed that sanction, not Venezuela.
Over the past few weeks, we've seen U.S. helicopters literally pirate and hijack Venezuelan oil ships and tankers. And we thought that was, you know, madness in real time. And of course, now we see this full-blown invasion and the kidnapping. You mentioned the Monroe Doctrine. I wanted to ask, how does the current invasion fit into the historical pattern of the Monroe Doctrine?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think James Monroe would be very proud of Trump in that regard. So the Monroe Doctrine was basically used as a pretext to allegedly keep Europe out of the Americas back in the 19th century, but really James Monroe and then other presidents used that to justify intervention in Latin America and the Caribbean. And, you know, the list is way too long of the governments that have been deposed, the invasions that the United States has carried out in Latin America and the Caribbean. But this kidnapping, you know, you were talking about some of the presidents earlier who have been the target of U.S. actions. And the one that really springs to mind is Jean-Bertrand d'Aristide in Haiti, when he was kidnapped by the United States in a very kind of similar operation. President Obama was in power, you had Secretary of State John Kerry say that the Monroe Doctrine was over. And there was this kind of hope in Latin America, in the Caribbean, that, you know, relations between the United States and the many countries in the region would be held on the basis of mutual respect and dialogue and sovereignty. And in fact, in Latin America and the Caribbean, they signed what is known as the Zone of Peace Agreement, the CELAC, the Community of Latin American and Caribbean Countries, which is this multilateral organization, CELAC. They signed the Zone of Peace Agreement, and the United States said it would abide by it. They weren't invited to sign it because they're not part of the organization, but they said they would abide by it. And now they're very clearly not. And, you know, it's gone from hijacking, really, the piracy on the high seas of these tankers, of which there have been two that have been seized by the United States so far, containing about 2 million barrels of oil. A third one they've been chasing for weeks, and now Russia has asked them not to seize it. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there. But it's gone from that sort of piracy to kidnapping, and it's gangsterism. You know, this is a country that, you know, prides itself on being a force for democracy and human rights in the world, allegedly. But of course, it's not that, and it's never been that. And I think right now, what they're doing to Venezuela, and of course, what they're doing to Gaza and the Palestinian people, and what they've historically done around the world, is really kind of taking that mask off of what the United States stands for. And, you know, Trump in that regard is useful in the sense that he doesn't put this veneer of human rights and democracy, this language, this rhetoric around it. And he's very clear about what the United States wants. He wants their oil. And so he wants control of Venezuela.
You're checking out Hard Knock Radio. We are live on broadcasting through the Pacific Radio Network. I am Kalonji Changa, filling in for Davey D. Our guest today is Leonardo Flores, political analyst, activist, and founding member of the Venezuela Solidarity Network. Leonardo, U.S. propaganda, the job is to definitely confuse and to mislead and misdirect the people. I've seen a number of different folks on social media and, you know, even quote unquote political organizations that are saying that, you know, the people of Venezuela are dancing in the street. They are, you know, happy that Maduro's captured and that Trump has come in on a white horse and saved the day and everything's all good. And I was telling some folks, I said, well, you know, you can get some footage of MAGA supporters dancing in the street when Trump was reelected, but that doesn't represent the U.S. as a whole. Talk to us about these folks that we see in the streets that are celebrating, saying that, you know, Maduro is some type of criminal and that the U.S. has come along and somehow Trump is a good guy now.
Yeah, I mean, I think the videos, at least that I've seen, of Venezuelans dancing in the streets, they may be Venezuelans, but they're certainly not in Venezuela, right? So we've seen a kind of right-wing Venezuelan rallies in New York and Miami and other cities of the world. But in Venezuela itself, the opposite is happening. It's the Chavistas, the people who back President Maduro, the grassroots of the Bolivarian Revolution who are on the streets, that have been on the streets since very early morning Saturday and since 4 a.m. Demanding the return of President Maduro and Cilia Flores, the first lady. And they want, you know, to bring them back. And I think that's been the message that we're seeing from Venezuelans in Venezuela. Venezuelans abroad, you know, particularly in NATO countries, they are, you know, the right-wing fascists are overrepresented in those diaspora populations. So, for example, I live in Washington, D.C., and there is a big Venezuelan community now that's grown here over the last 7 years or so. And many, not all of them, of course, but many of them are hard right-wing. Many of them are Trump supporters, and they are very ecstatic to some degree. But they are also now starting to question what's going on, because in their minds, you know, Delcy Rodriguez, the new interim president of Venezuela, she's the vice president, and she's very clear that she was on TV yesterday saying, you know, that the government is going to continue, that they continue, that President Maduro is still the president, and that he's going to fill out his term, even if he's not in the country, that they're going to fill it, his term is going to be completed for him until. And so, you know, this idea that somehow the government in Venezuela there's been regime change there, it's not the case. The government remains completely intact, and Venezuela's fascists, you know, they may have had a very temporary victory in terms of getting rid of Maduro and having him be in prison in the United States right now in a jail, but certainly their leaders have been snubbed by Trump, actually. And I think I mentioned earlier, and Trump had a press conference, kind of a long one yesterday, where he touched on a wide range of issues, but he mentioned kind of offhand that he had spoken to Maria Corina Machado, who's a Venezuelan opposition leader, very famous for, of course, winning the Nobel Prize despite calling for war and sanctions on the Venezuelan people. So, you know, a supposed peace activist who thinks that war is love. That's a quote from her. And so she was described by Trump as not having any support within Venezuela, and that's true. And so, you know, we haven't, this idea that somehow Venezuelans are happy that Maduro's gone is not really based on the reality on the ground in Venezuela. In fact, the Venezuelan people are really upset and angry. And, you know, I think they've been talking now for weeks in Venezuela about moving from a peaceful struggle, a peaceful resolution, to an armed struggle, an armed revolution. And so, you know, Chavez used to say that this is a peaceful resolution, but we're armed. And now it's becoming clear that peace in Venezuela is going to be difficult to protect, and that the people are becoming more and more connected to both the military and the police. There's something called in Venezuela, this concept of a civil military and now police union, a unity between all three factors, you know, because the police in Venezuela are they don't serve the interests of the elite necessarily. And so we've seen 8 million people join Venezuela's militias. Right. And so to talk about propaganda, it's a kind of funny dictatorship that's so quote unquote that hands out weapons to people, right? So we've seen images of poor people in Venezuela being handed weapons, being trained in how to use them. In any actual dictatorship, that would mean the end of the dictatorship, right? But in Venezuela, what it means, it's strengthening the popular bases to defend itself against American imperialism.
Absolutely, absolutely. We definitely appreciate you sharing that with us. Propaganda is a hell of a drug. General Dan Kane, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he provided what was considered a detailed account of how the U.S. military's mission to quote-unquote apprehend Maduro and his wife Sunday morning. He said that the mission was called Operation Absolute Resolve, that more than 150 aircrafts were involved, including fighter aircraft, bombers, surveillance aircrafts, intelligence aircrafts, and helicopters. He said the entire joint force was involved in the mission: Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, Space Force, intelligence agencies, etc. For you and other Venezuelans who have been checking out what's been taking place over the past few months, did you see this coming? Was this expected, or was it as shocking to you as it was the rest of the world?
No, this in particular was very shocking because Venezuela actually has air defenses. They've got a lot of Chinese radar systems. They've got missiles, surface-to-air missiles from Russia that can be used to threaten some of these planes that the United States has been flying near Venezuela for over the last several months, and actually in Venezuela on Saturday morning. So it was very shocking. I think one of the things that the Trump administration is saying is that they had a source inside the Venezuelan government that kind of paved the way for this attack. I think that may be true. But obviously, it's hard to say because there is so much propaganda. And it's also, you know, one of the aspects of the psychological warfare that the United States has been engaging in has been to try to cause divisions within Chavismo, the movement that backs President Maduro, and to try to cause divisions with the Venezuelan, within the Venezuelan armed forces. And we haven't seen that on a mass scale at all over the past 10 years. But we have seen every once in a while there's a traitor that's caught, that's been helping the United States in some way. So, for example, way back in 2019, you had when Juan Guaido declared himself president, basically at the U.S. insistence backing. In that year, in April of that year, there was an attempted coup. And at that point, you know, the Trump administration really thought at then that they had were about to destroy the Venezuelan government. But it turns out that, you know, at that point, that one of the coup leaders was actually a double agent and was telling Venezuelans everything that was happening. But it turned out that there was also a well-placed, highly influential person within the Venezuelan government that was collaborating with the United States. And he eventually was, you know, sent to jail, or I think believe he's in house arrest right now and under investigation for his involvement in that particular coup in 2019. So right now, I think we're seeing something similar, perhaps, but it's hard to speculate, right? And I don't want to speculate too much because the focus shouldn't be on how the United States did this. It should be on what is going on in the first place, that the United States thought it has somehow the moral and legal authority to carry this out, and we're not really hearing enough from politicians within the United States denouncing this. I think Hakeem Jeffries said something the other day, or just yesterday or today, where it was kind of a very milquetoast response, saying, well, he should have gotten congressional approval first. Well, no, this isn't about giving Trump congressional approval to remove the president of another country and kidnap him and to bomb another country. I don't care about congressional approval. I want them to stop the Trump administration from doing this. You know, this idea that, oh, he went around Congress. No, Congress has to stop this, right? It's not about getting Congress to rubber stamp Trump. They have to find a way to stop this. I don't know that they're going to. I think the people who were going to stop this, if anyone, are the Venezuelan people.
Right. No, I definitely, Hakeem Jeffries clearly bumped his head a long time ago. You mentioned Chavismo. Can you explain the significance of the 1958 Pontificio Pact and how it led to the rise of Chavismo?
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up because that's something that we haven't really, I don't really talk much as a Venezuela solidarity activist I don't talk enough about some of the lessons that we can learn here in the United States about Venezuela. So the Punto Fijo Pact was this, you know, in Venezuela, there was a revolution that overthrew a dictator, and then basically two parties came into power, and they signed this pact where they said that they're basically going to alternate power and they're going to exclude all other political actors. It was a two-party, it was a duopoly, basically, an oligarchic duopoly. And if you're thinking to yourself, well, hey, that sounds pretty kind of what we have here in the United States, it's exactly the same, right? And this oligarchic duopoly lasted about 40 years, and they controlled not just the government, but they also controlled the media and the economy to the exclusion of everyday Venezuelans. So despite the fact that Venezuela is very oil rich during this period in time, I'm talking mid to late 20th century, Venezuela had a high rate of poverty and it was the most unequal country in perhaps the world at the time in terms of economic inequalities. Then Chavez comes into power. He wins elections in 1998 with a promise to rewrite the constitution and to let the people take part in writing the constitution and then to vote on the constitution by referendum. And this broke apart the duopoly, and it created a mass grassroots movement that wanted people's power. And that's what we're seeing here today in Venezuela. You know, all the propaganda says, oh, Maduro's a dictator, that Venezuela has no democracy. That's an outright lie. I can sit here and honestly say that the Venezuela is more democratic than the United States of America. I've lived in both countries. I've experienced both governments. I've voted in elections both here and there because I'm a dual citizen. And certainly there's more of a democracy in Venezuela than in the United States. And because here in the United States, we live under this duopoly and we have to figure out how to break free of it. And Chavez, you know, posits a path. And it maybe it's not the same path that we should take here in the United States, but it's certainly a path that we should understand and study to see how the Venezuelan people broke their duopoly. And they broke it by electing Chavez, who's basically kind of an outsider at the time. And they elected him at a time when both the two parties that were alternating power were at historic lows in terms of popularity, which is very much what we see right now in terms of the Republicans and the Democrats. And then he was elected and he called for a new constitution. So this, and this path of kind of a constituent or constitutional assembly leading to a new constitution, a new government, and a refoundation of the country was something that also Bolivia followed, that Ecuador tried to follow. And so we need to start learning from these lessons here in the United States to break the duopoly that runs our own lives.
Leonardo, you mentioned Bolivia. What does the capture of Maduro mean for the grassroots Bolivarian circles and communal councils?
Yeah, I mean, I think they've lost. So Venezuela has, just to back up a little bit, Venezuela has this form of democracy card called participatory and protagonistic democracy. It's a democracy where you are supposed to be active, not just every 2 or 4 years to vote, but active constantly within your own community, building democracy at the grassroots, building it out from there, creating an economic democracy as well. And so that's what we're seeing in terms of the communes. President Maduro has been the top champion of the communes since the passing of President Chavez in 2013. And the communes have lost, you know, a big hero right now. And I think we're going to see the Venezuelan resistance is going to be strongest from these communes. I think the communes are holding strong. I think certainly the fact that there has been no regime change is going to be very positive for the communes, because certainly they would be the first targets of any regime change. And when I say targets, I mean that literally. I think part of the plan of Venezuela's fascists is to basically wipe out anyone that they consider a communard, anyone that has been very active in social movements. And they've been very clear about this, about their kind of violent fantasies for regime change if they should ever come back into power. And then kind of internationally, because you also mentioned Bolivia, which I had mentioned too, you know, Venezuela has long been kind of a beacon for left-wing activism and left-wing politics throughout Latin America and the Caribbean. And I think it's going to continue to be so. And I think what we have seen, kind of a mixed bag in terms of electoral results for the left in Latin America over the last several years, certainly disheartened by, the electoral coup in Honduras, the loss of the mass party in Bolivia. But I think the fact that now the United States is so openly attacking Venezuela is going to reinvigorate the left throughout the hemisphere.
Thank you. Thank you. Venezuela, this assault, this invasion, you know, of course it's impacted, as you mentioned, not only Venezuela, but other places in Latin America, including Cuba, Haiti, and other spaces. Can you speak to that? Like, what does this mean for Latin America and globally? What does this invasion mean? Because I think that some folks are just looking at it as a beef between Trump and Maduro, or the U.S. trying to bring some type of democracy to, you know, to Venezuela. But what does this mean economically for, you know, surrounding countries and spaces throughout the world?
Yeah, I think one of the things that has really kind of flown under the radar a little bit since this attack on Venezuela yesterday, on Friday night, Saturday morning, is that the Trump administration has really been threatening other countries throughout Latin America and the Caribbean. It's not just Venezuela, right? So we talk about the 32 strikes on boats and how some of them have been in the Pacific. So in fact, 20 of the 32 strikes have been in the Pacific. Venezuela, again, doesn't have Pacific coastline. So these are strikes on other countries, on the citizens of other countries. Trump, just recently, we found out that Stephen Miller, who is Trump's right-hand Nazi, as I like to call him, wanted to bomb Mexico first. And, yeah. You know, and when I'm talking about last year, before this aggression against Venezuela had really gotten started, his plan was to bomb Mexico first, to go after cartels there, and then to go find other countries. And then just yesterday on Fox and Friends, President Trump said that Mexico is run by cartels. So he's openly threatening the government of Mexico. Secretary Rubio said that the Cubans should watch out. So they're openly threatening Cuba. They've been talking about sending an invasion force to Haiti for a couple of years now. So it's not just Venezuela that's under attack. It's all of the hemisphere that's under attack. And we see it. And it's easy to prove. So, for example, in the electoral coup that took place in Honduras in November, the U.S. interfered heavily in those elections. Heavily. And they carried out this electoral coup. It was a massive fraud that they carried out. And the U.S. has been interfering in Colombia. They decertified Colombia in the war on drugs, despite the fact that President Petro in Colombia has been one of the few Colombian presidents to actually tackle the drug trade, because many Colombian presidents in the past were heavily involved themselves in the drug trade, like Álvaro Uribe, for example. And we saw the Trump administration impose high tariffs on Brazil because they dared to put Bolsonaro, their former president, in jail. And both Colombia and Brazil have elections next year, or this year rather, later this year, and the United States is going to try to interfere in those. And if the results don't pan out as the United States likes, they're going to either impose sanctions, or they're going to bomb, or they're going to do something, because they can't afford to have more left-wing governments in the region, because they want to control and dominate the region entirely. So this attack isn't just on Venezuela, and the economic impacts of it's hard to say, because, you know, that Trump administration claims that there's a total oil blockade on Venezuela, but first of all, it's not true. Chevron still has a license to operate in Venezuela, and they're allowed to sell oil to the United States, and the U.S. ships let those tankers go through. But also, the U.S. isn't going after every tanker that goes into Venezuela. They're certainly, you know, trying to, but they haven't been able to yet. But it's I mentioned I was at a rally yesterday, and in my speech, I mentioned that it's not just an attack on Venezuela, it's an attack on all of Latin America. It's also an attack on us right here at home, because if you listen to Trump's press conference yesterday, it was supposed to be about Venezuela, and then suddenly he just veered off topic to talk about the National Guard in Washington, D.C., in Chicago, in Portland, L.A., New Orleans, right? So yeah. At the same time that this deployment happened in August against Venezuela, it was the same week that Trump deployed the National Guard to Washington, D.C. And behind this is not just a distraction about Epstein, which it certainly is, that's a big part of it, but also there's something deeper, and that's like the white supremacy of the Trump administration, right? In his campaign, he was so openly white supremacist, not just obviously against black people and his anti-black racism, which goes back decades and we all know about it, and of course against migrants of all kinds, but particularly from Latin America, particularly from Venezuela. So while he's attacking migrants here in the United States, he's attacking black and brown communities here in the United States, he's bombing us in Latin America too, and he's threatening war against all of us, not just Venezuela, all of us.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'm glad you said that. One of the things you mentioned cartels in Mexico under the guise of a war on drugs. You know, they invaded Venezuela, and we know that this is a ongoing thing. Whenever there's a problem with anyone, it's the war on poverty, the war on drugs, the war on terrorism, so on and so forth. I wanted to as how does the U.S. media's framing of narco-terrorism compare to the historical demonization of leaders like Noriega or Gaddafi?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly when the United States decides to target a leader, the U.S. media goes in lockstep with them. And so we saw that, you know, Noriega was a U.S. ally until suddenly he wasn't, and then he became this boogeyman, right? We've seen it time and time again. The same happened with Fidel Castro, actually. He was loved by the U.S. media at first, and then the United States government started to turn against Castro, and then suddenly we see all these articles saying that, oh, Castro is somehow this corrupt dude, one of the richest men in the world, and obviously none of it was true. And the same thing has happened in Venezuela. And before, you know, I go into that, let me just emphasize real quick that this pretext about drugs in Venezuela is totally absurd, and it's false, and the United States knows it. So the U.S., the DEA, publishes every year this thing called the National Drug Threat Assessment. It's a report on, you know, basically the threat of drugs throughout the entire world, particularly in this hemisphere, though. According to this DEA report, they call the Tren de Aragua, which is one of the two alleged cartels that the Trump administration is after, they call them, and this is a direct quote, small-scale drug traffickers. In fact, the U.S. intelligence, the National Intelligence Council, in a memo that was leaked last year, they admitted that Maduro doesn't control or collaborate with the Tren de Aragua, and that the Venezuelan government actually fights kinetically against the Tren de Aragua. The other cartel that's mentioned a lot is the so-called Cartel de los Soles. And that one is wild because it's a cartel that doesn't even exist. Going back to 20 years of these National Drug Threat Assessment, these DEA reports, you will not find a single reference to the so-called Cartel de los Soles. You'll find page after page of the Jalisco Cartel and the Nueva Generación, Sinaloa Cartel, some of these kind of major cartels in Mexico, in Colombia, in other countries, but nothing about any cartel in Venezuela because there aren't any. Because there's no fentanyl production or traffic in Venezuela, there's no cocaine production in Venezuela, and at most, and this is figure comes from the DEA itself, at most 5% of the world's cocaine traffics through Venezuela because one of the top producers is Colombia and they share a border that's about 2,400 kilometers long. So, but the thing is that way back before Chavez, when Venezuela was basically one of the top allies of the United States in Latin America, if not the top ally, in the early 90s, 53% of cocaine flowed through Venezuela. Today, it's less than 5%. So this ridiculous, you know, pretext that it's a war on drugs, it's just a total, total fabrication. And the United States knows it. And unfortunately, the media, the mainstream media, corporate media, is not pushing back on this nearly enough.
So why do you think the people are going for it? I mean, do you think it's a matter of ignorance? Is it because, here's a Latin American country, you know, or a Spanish-speaking country, so, you know, it must be true? What do you think?
I think that's part of it. But I also think that most people aren't going for it because we've seen the polls and people are against the war on Venezuela. In fact, 70% in a poll taken in late November, 70% of the American people would be against a U.S. invasion of Venezuela. There are some within kind of the MAGA movement that are like thanking Trump for taking out these fentanyl traffickers. And again, Venezuela doesn't produce or traffic fentanyl. So really, Trump has really manipulated his base into thinking he's going after fentanyl and opioids when he's not. And I think people are slowly coming to understand that because there have been some articles saying, well, even the U.S. doesn't think that a lot of this cocaine is coming through Venezuela. So some of it is just plain ignorance. Some of it is propaganda. But I think we're managing to break through that a little bit. Unfortunately, you know, many people in the United States don't care enough about foreign policy and don't really draw the connection to how, say, a $1 trillion Pentagon budget affects their lives, and it affects us all, because if it's $1 trillion for the Pentagon to kidnap the president of Venezuela, that's a mess money for us, for schools and hospitals and education and infrastructure, right? So there's a direct connection. And once we understand how all of this, our tax money, is being used to kill people overseas and to oppress people and to destroy revolutions, we should, you know, take a stand against that and say, like, no, our money should go for our own needs in our own communities, not to bomb people overseas.
How do you feel U.S. sanctions since 2015 set the stage for this direct military action?
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up again, because the sanctions have been really horrible against Venezuela. And there was a report by the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive think tank in D.C. They published this report in 2019 that found that in the first year of the Trump sectoral sanctions alone, that's to say in 2017, 2018, that calendar year, 40,000 Venezuelans died because of U.S. sanctions. There was another article that came out this past summer, summer of 2025, in The Lancet, which is this kind of prestigious academic journal. And the writers of that article, the researchers, found that sanctions globally kill 560,000 people every single year, and more than half of those victims are children. And we've seen that play out in Venezuela. We've seen it because the sanctions caused a 99% drop in government revenues. And we're talking about a government that spent most of its budget, I'm talking roughly 80% or more, on social investment, whether it was education, health, or housing. And so it set the stage, these sanctions set the stage for this attack, because they've been slowly weakening Venezuela for many years, causing a migration crisis, because we know that sanctions cause migration. That's been proven by study after study. And so not the Trump administration caused this migration crisis, caused basically chaos in Venezuela for a couple of years, and weakened Venezuela enough that now it could just send its 150 planes and snatch the president out of his bedroom. And so the two are very intimately linked. It's all part of a what broader hybrid war against Venezuela that is not just includes these, you know, the bombings and the kidnapping and the naval deployment, but includes an aspect of economic warfare. It includes propaganda warfare, because Maduro has been demonized in this media for at least 10, 15 years, right? The way they write about him and say the New York Times or Washington Post, you'd think he's the devil incarnate. Well, you know what? He's not at all. He's actually a very humble man, a smart man, and he's not on the Epstein list, for one thing, And not only that, but he's undertaken a fight against corruption in Venezuela that's really admirable. And it, to me, that's one of the things that saddens me most, in addition to the loss of life on this attack, this bombing of Caracas, is to see this man who is really widely respected internationally too, because he was Venezuela's foreign minister under Chavez for many years, to see him in chains and being kind of paraded in front of cameras in New York, it's really quite sad.
Definitely, we appreciate you coming on today. I'm going to hit you with this final question and I'm gonna let you go about your day, because I know, you know, it's a whole lot going on and you are necessary not only to the Venezuelan community, but to organizers home and abroad. I want to ask you, how can organizers here in the U.S. best show solidarity with the Venezuelan community during this occupation? Because I know that, you know, many have acted swiftly and they've organized protests, so on and so forth, in the streets. We had some folks on yesterday that were organizing in the streets of Paris and Ghana, so on and so forth. How can folks, organizers here in the U.S. and abroad, best show solidarity?
Yeah, so actually one of the things that really heartened me was that yet on Saturday, January 3rd, after we learned of this attack, and within less than 12 hours of a call, we saw protests in 70 U.S. cities against this illegal action, this illegal war, this kidnapping of President Maduro. If you are not connected to an organization that's taking action, connect to an organization that's taking action. If you are part of an organization and your organization hasn't done anything, find a way to do something. Even if it's like just being out on the street with a couple of signs, that's important because that changes people's minds. Do letters to the editor, do political education, follow us at the Venezuela Solidarity Network, venezuelasolidaritynetwork.org. Find folks that are working on anti-imperialism and join them. Because again, this is not just against Venezuela, this is an attack on all of us. If you've been active in the genocide against Palestine continue to do that, because these two are intimately linked. I mean, there is, in my mind, there's no distinction between Palestine and Venezuela in the sense of what they're trying to do, and they're just trying to kill people and take over their land and take over their resources and expel them and be, continue to be active and find ways to stand up to U.S. imperialism and really find ways to draw those connections between the many fights that we have here at home, whether it's healthcare, whether it's police terror, whether it's migrant justice, whether it's climate justice, and militarism. Because if we cannot take out these kind of people, not take out, but if we can't challenge this idea that militarism must rule supreme within the United States, the state, the government, then really our own other struggles, we have little hope of winning them. Because militarism just takes over so much of not just our budget, but of our mindset, of particularly with all this propaganda that we see, where every war that the United States engages in is a just war, according to mainstream media, right? And so we have to continue to fight back against that and organize and connect, organize in your community. That's my message.
No doubt. Leonardo, we appreciate you joining Hard Knock Radio today. Looking forward to you coming back on and updating us on what's going on in Venezuela. We know that, you know, the people of Venezuela will be victorious, just like the people of the world. And we know that imperialism and global hegemony will not win.
That's
so
right.
We will continue.
Thank you so much for the invite, Kalonji.
Thank you, Leonardo. You're checking out Hard Knock Radio. This is Pacifica Radio Network. I am Kalonji Changa, filling in for Davey D. Our guest today was Leonardo Flores. Make sure you check Leonardo out along with the Venezuela Solidarity Network. We'll be back at you. Stay tuned.
Colors that you fly, love just one nation, and the whole world we divide. You say you're sorry, there is no other choice. God bless the people now. Cannot raise their voice. We can chase down all our enemies, bring them to their knees. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. Whoa. Flesh and burning pain. So I sing out to the masses, stand up if you're still sane. To all of us gone crazy, I sing this one refrain. We can chase down all our enemies, bring them to their knees. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. Whoa, we may even find a solution to hunger. Bomb it into peace.
Turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program, turn in for the real talk. Don't stop. EMN at it again. Sandman, Dadaman, Chris Juwan Kim. Yeah. Innovation, stimulating ill conversation. Anything else, just imitation. Simulation, step into the zone. The Bay Area zone. Hard Knock Radio, let's go. Big shout out Anita and Davey D. Yeah, right, feel me. Yeah. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Kinda crazy though. Oakland stand up.
Yeah. Stand up.
Ensemble Big Night Wolves.
Yeah. Kansas City.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bellevue. Yeah. Come on. Check out.
Why every novice think they hard knock when they ain't going all in and ain't paid the cost for the fee? Hating that they made they beats trying to eat till they ready from the steel crate beats. Say, please. Maybe they'll save you a seat at the table with a great bread making a speech. Say, you beast and their lovers are neighbors. Shade on your name in the street. Let's go. Hey, Anita and Davey D.
Real Talk Radio. You are now rocking with the best in the West.
West Coast. Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
East Coast.
That which is to come. It is foolish for us to predict what is to come. For life is full of variables, and none can see the whole. But sometimes, some things are so clear that they impress themselves upon the mind and leave a mark that cannot be undone. This seems to be such a time. The turning gears of this machine are not just the ruinous effects of tariffs, but the expressed intentions of the ultra-rich class to transform the world of work through the introduction of AI, artificial intelligence. These devices represent a profound change in the working place. So much so that AI will soon replace some 40% of entry-level jobs in the economy, already replacing college students and college graduates who, despite their degrees, can't find a job. This reality was reflected in a public statement made recently by the world's richest man, Elon Musk, when he said, work will be optional. What this means in the real world is that for the first time since the Industrial Revolution, capital is able to use technology, like AI, non-human labor, to generate its massive profits. These non-human technologies don't sleep, they don't eat, they don't take vacations, they don't strike. They perform complex tasks as long as energy sources can be provided. Yes, work may be optional, but what about eating? Is that too optional? AI only eats energy and data. The ultra-rich are reshaping the world literally before our very eyes, and not for the better. Marx said that capitalism breaks down all Chinese walls. In other words, it destroys anything in its hunger for profits. In Capital, Marx recounts how the working class came into being. It isn't natural like trees or grass. It was formed by the theft of the common lands of the common people, the so-called commoners. Their lands, the commons, were walled off, and Parliament outlawed the wood and growth on the trees to commoners by making it a crime. These laws and practices were designed to force commoners into noisy, dirty factories to work for manufacturers of products. In fact, Marx explains that that governments terrorize the commoners by brutish punishments like hanging for pickpockets, who, by the way, were so bold that they picked pockets during public executions. Let's bring it back to the present and the future. What happens to the working class when there are no jobs? Do you expect the uber-rich to take care of them? Really? Do you expect the super-rich, most of whom don't even pay taxes, to take care of you? We shall see economic dislocation and destruction like generations haven't seen since the 1930s. We live in an era not of casino capitalism, nor even crony capitalism. This is gangster capitalism, where everything not nailed down is stolen. That's the real reasons behind tariffs: to take what is takeable, period. The investor class is betting its money on AI, non-human labor, to enrich itself perpetually. With love, not fear. This is Mumia Abu Jamal.
Hard Knock Radio. We're rocking with Picasso.
What?
And Maya.
Who?
My last name is Susana. Yeah, yeah.
Miss, I'm ready for the road. Put me upon the radio, I'm ready for the road. We no come for players, so me touch the stage show. Fire does a blaze, so them never they know. KBO around the place. No, 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 yeah. Yeah, man, I'ma say this is the KBO of Full Strength Community Radio. And you know it's Kabaka Pyramid representing and Full Dawson. Baby Rock family, you don't know. Kingston, Jamaica, we say. Yeah, Portland, it's not normal.
Hello, I'm Eugene Rashad. Join me every Saturday from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. for the best in jazz on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 on your FM dot.
But I dig, and I know you dig, because I got four requests for this thing already today. Strutting right with it.
That was KBOO volunteer disc jockey George Page. Page has been playing jazz and popular black music on KBOO for the past 12 years.
What I do to the audience I draw, hopefully, is to please them with all types of black music. Mostly what you can't hear as a rule on larger black-oriented stations in L.A. or San Francisco. I play a lot of blues and a lot of jazz. All of it's black-oriented, but it's not the cuts you're going to hear on the other jazz shows. It's not the cuts you're going to hear on other stations, because other stations just don't play jazz and blues in a black vein the way I do here.
This is Bird Note. It's one of those clear, quiet winter mornings on the bay. The silence is broken by a series of loud, insistent calls. What's the source of this wild refrain? There, 100 yards out where the water deepens, is a small cluster of sea ducks, dressed mostly in white. They're long-tailed ducks, back for the winter from nesting far to the north. Long-tailed ducks are named for the male's plumage. Long, slender tail plumes extend almost a foot behind his body. Long-tailed ducks are far more vocal than most ducks, a feature that has earned them a host of charming nicknames. The name that probably comes closest to capturing the sound of the male's call is from the Cree language, Hahawe. This winter, along either coast or on the Great Lakes, listen for long-tailed ducks. By listening, you'll have an advantage, because they can be hard to spot. When they're feeding, long-tailed ducks spend a lot of time underwater, and they can dive as deep as 200 feet. Even so, you can get a good look at a long-tailed duck on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein. This episode is dedicated to Dan Moore for his many years of board service and generous support of BirdNote.
Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO, Portland.
KBOO's zine, The Boo Beat, is back with a second issue, featuring KBOO's program guide.